Our project this evening is to bring together the various elements of this series of discussions on the mysticism of the Kabbalah. And perhaps there is no better way of climaxing our little program of research than through the symbolism of the everlasting house. Nearly all peoples scattered throughout the culture systems of mankind who have attained a high platform of ethics or civilization have conceived that the ultimate purpose of human society is to create or reveal through conduct a way of life that brings peace, harmony, dignity, and honor to all men. In Buddhism, for example, we have the tradition of the Maitreya, the teacher who is to come and who is to rule over an enlightened world. Certainly, the messianic concept in Christianity sustains this same general teaching. In Hindu India, the concept of the 10th avatar of Vishnu, the one who is to come, who is to restore the sacred institutions and to bring human beings together in brotherhood and fraternity. This avatar also is to rule over an enlightened world. We also have among most peoples the idea that heaven is a vast empire, that like the kingdom of earth, the kingdom of heaven is the orderly abode of the sovereign deities and powers that govern the world. Old nations conceived of heaven as a magnificent palace city, a city perfect, like the New Jerusalem, a city wherein the blessed and the redeemed dwelt together in eternal bliss. The old Egyptians had the same kind of a philosophy. They believed that in the world of the gods was the splendid palace temple of Osiris, Lord of the quick and the dead, and that from his throne, this great deity administered not only his own spiritual domain, but prepared the way for the descent of his spiritual kingdom into the mortal world, where it would be led and guarded and guided and ruled by his beloved son, Horus, the Golden Hawk. Thus, everywhere, man had the internal archetypal vision of a world fashioned to his heart's desire, a world in which the evils that we know are no more, but that all things are ruled and governed in righteousness, and that after a certain length of time, the kings and rulers of this world would return their crowns and scepters to the eternal king, and that the great one who fashioned all things will finally be the full ruler of his redeemed peoples. This vision probably may be held to be a certain type of daydream. Every human being lives from day to day in the hope of a victorious tomorrow. We plan, we labor, we struggle, not for the day alone, but to ensure some kind of future. The way we live now, we seldom attain this future. One by one, we drop away when it seems we have just begun to learn how to live. But in the subconscious of man, the archetype of a proper life way has always existed. Even among so-called less advanced people, there are evidences of the same general thinking. And this thinking goes a little further. It sort of implies that this heavenly city, this abode of the blessed, already exists somewhere in the mysteries of the unknown. Long ago, we could place this city somewhere on earth, in a remote region unexplored by men. Many legends still come to us of mysterious spiritual centers in the wide expanse of the Trans-Himavat, or perhaps beyond the Tibetan desert of Gobi. Exploration, however, has forced this concept further and further from a material acceptance. And we have come almost to a complete agreement that this better world, this heavenly kingdom, as Jesus said, is not of this world, but rests in some larger and better state beyond our present condition. If, however, there are rules and laws governing the world, the older peoples, including the Jewish mystics, recognized that there were two orders of government: government by men and government by God. The governments of men might be splendid, luxurious, magnificent, and their palaces bewildered the senses. But these governments by men were in large measure corrupt. Selfishness, egotism, tyranny were always present, and the rich and the powerful exploited the weak and the helpless. Thus, there was no real solution to man's dream of a golden age to be found merely in the temporal estates of nations. Long ago, when men believed in the divine right of kings and held that temporal rulers were actually governing by the will and sanction of God, and perhaps these rulers themselves were caught up in a sense of spiritual responsibility, things went better. But in our more modern historical times, men have regarded themselves increasingly as temporal beings, capable and entitled to advance their own destinies at the expense of each other. So the golden kingdoms of the future mingle with the mysterious spiritual empires of the past. And in the middle distance, where now we dwell, there is very much of earth and very little of heaven. Also, we must realize that the archetype of the ultimate state of man was strangely related to this mysterious experience of man's origin. If the future is to become increasingly better, the remote past was also better. For in the ancient times, it was believed that the gods walked with men, that the ways of heaven flourished upon earth, and that at the very beginning of time, divine institutions were established for the good of men, that laws were revealed, and that the first civilizers of nations were divinely inspired and spiritually enlightened beings. These too are vanished away in the limbo of things forgotten. But we seem to have a lingering memory of the golden age that once was. And it gives us a certain symbolism about the golden age that is to come. Now, when Solomon became king over Israel, he resolved to fulfill the work of his father David, who had sworn that he would build a house to the Lord upon the Mount Moriah, which is in Jerusalem. So Solomon proceeded to call upon the resources of his people, upon his own private fortune, and upon the friendship of neighboring kings and rulers. And he resolved to perfect the temple of the living God, in which was to rest the Ark of the Covenant that had accompanied the children of Israel in their long journey through the wilderness. And Solomon, therefore, brought together the wisest and the most skillful of workmen. And he called upon his friend and his father's friend, Hiram, king of Tyre. And this great monarch of Tyre supplied skilled workmen and materials and wood, which was floated down from the hills of Lebanon in order that it might become the very beams and rafters of the glorious temple raised to the honor of God. And the workmen upon this task were divided into several groups according to their abilities. And some were drawers of water, and others were hewers of wood. And some were made foremen and masters over others. And those who were most skilled were given the most difficult and important work. And they trewed the stones, and they placed upon each stone their mark, the mark of the faithful workman. And also out of Tyre came a most cunning artisan, referred to in the Bible as Hiram the artificer. He was the one that cast the vessels of metal for the temple of the king. And he designed the great curtains and had to do with all the ornaments. And he cast the great columns that were to go before the porch of the house. And he made marvelous festoons of pomegranates and wonderful wreaths of flowers. And he also fashioned the utensils of the priests, and a molten sea borne upon the back of 12 oxen. It was to be a great and noble house indeed. And though its proportions and dimensions were not great in the term of modern architecture, it was a building of wonderful and cunning design. And into its construction was incorporated all the knowledge of the artificers of Syria and the wise men of the desert, and the guilds of workmen labored exceedingly upon the perfection of this house. Now, the reason for all this seemed to be, first of all, the universal recognition of the importance of the sanctuary of God standing in the world. In other words, this temple was a microcosm of heaven. It was a doorway, a gate, or a bridge between mortality and the divine condition. It was here that the priest could enter in and commune with God, and the deity could descend between the wings of the cherubim and bestow his wisdom and his laws upon his people. And we are told in the book of Kings that this great temple was built without the voice of workmen or the sound of hammers. We are also rather clearly reminded that this house took 33 years to build, and that in the building of it, a wonderful symbolism was involved, a symbolism which many Bible students have not taken as seriously as they should. Later, Jesus told his disciples that if the temple was destroyed, he could restore it in 3 days. And his disciples and the multitude decided that he was referring to his own body as a living temple of God. The house of Solomon the king was designed like the mystery of the human body. It represented a shrine or sanctuary fashioned in the likeness of man. And all its instruments and vessels were parts of man's own structure, as was also the original, the temple in the wilderness, from which the design was basically derived. Also, we know that the tabernacle, its ark, and its sacred vessels were brought from Egypt, and that designs and representations are to be found upon the monuments of the Egyptians, which are almost identical with those described in the Temple of Solomon. The Kabbalists, being mystics, could not be completely held to the literal story of the building of a house. First of all, they maintained that the temple upon Mount Moriah stood on the earth directly beneath the eternal temple of God in heaven, that the earthly house was a kind of a long shadow of the heavenly house, that it was not only a symbol of God's habitation, but also a kind of covenant between God and man. Even more than this, it was the story of man, the story of the building of worlds, the building of structures, the unfoldment of society, and the final redemption of the human soul. Thus, in the Temple of Solomon, we have the symbolism of the great progress of the world. In the early years of the 17th century, Lord Bacon described the great structure of science as the house of the 6 days' work. He declared also that Solomon's house, as he called it, represented the total structure of man's mental and emotional maturity, that it signified all learning slowly building in the world, that it represented the slow but inevitable growth of human understanding, that we are all here as workmen upon the eternal house, which is sometime to be the symbol of a perfect human society. Thus, the Temple of Solomon, with all its workmen, with its wonderful plans and designs, its arts and its ornamentations, can represent the universe itself, built by the orders and hierarchs of heaven. And it can also represent this mysterious, invisible universe, the universe of human consciousness, the universe which man himself is fashioning through the growing and unfolding powers of his own faculties. And it is in this direction that the mind of Kabbalism penetrated most deeply. And to understand their thinking, we must go back with them a little way and study the minds and the thoughts of these old scholars and rabbins who sought to interpret what they regarded to be the divine destiny for man. According to the old instruction, and certainly the temple itself and the manner of its building sustains the belief, there actually exists upon earth only one humanity. Broadly, to this one humanity can be given the name, the chosen people. Chosen not by self-election, but by the election of heaven. That the tribes of Israel represent mysteriously all peoples. For these 12 tribes, with their affinity for the signs of the zodiac, do definitely represent the entire order of life that is born under the 12 signs, divided into tribes, each with certain attributes and qualities and characteristics. And from these tribes were chosen the artificers, the workers. And from each tribe, some were selected, both in the rites of the tabernacle and in the rites of the temple. Because the perfection of this work was the result of the union of all peoples, all faiths, all skills, all arts, and all sciences. Now, it was quite obvious to the medieval Kabbalists that arts and sciences, as we know them today, are not united. That each is an isolated course to which men have dedicated their minds and their hearts. The artist does not understand the musician. The musician does not understand the biologist. The architect may have very little sympathy for the astronomer, except perhaps some basic sense of mathematical kinship. All of the branches of learning are strangely divided as though they had been cursed at the time of the Tower of Babel. Everywhere human beings are striving to advance, not only themselves, but their causes. Great institutions rise. Great organizations are created. And our cities stand as monuments to tremendous ingenuity, industry, sacrifice, and death. Yet with all this tremendous labor, we have not achieved a sense of brotherhood. We have not sensed that we are all working together for the glory of the everlasting house. Thus, in mysticism, the effort was made to give human beings this sense of central consciousness, this sense of one destiny, that all forms of knowledge, separate and divided, are but the fragments of knowledge, that when we separate, we kill, and most of all, in separating, we kill unity, which is the power of oneness. As we break up knowledge into many brackets, our ignorance increases. For we become skillful in some things and totally unknowing about other things. As our general perspective narrows, our ability to live well as persons is also injured. We find we lack balance, we lack breadth of interest, we lack tolerance, understanding, sympathies. And little by little, our specializations and our limitations close in upon us. The old Kabbalist pointed out that one thing we must some way regain, and that is not only the vision of our unity, but the vision of our united purpose. It is not enough that we simply acknowledge that we are brothers, or that we are friends, or to go into some mystical concept and insist that somewhere in our spiritual roots we are one being. We must do more than this. We must do the works of one being. We must bring together not only our abstract concepts, but our practical achievements to realize that actually worship is the perfection of the structure of human society. That this structure will always be troublesome, inadequate, and in continuing danger until we unite our resources and build it into one enduring unit. The first thing, then, that we must have in order to build this everlasting house is a place upon which to build it. And Solomon went forth at night, and he found the threshing floor of the Jebusite. And he found that this floor was used by two brothers, each more concerned about the other than about himself. And when the grain was being divided, each brother returned at night and took from his own store and put upon the store of his brother. Solomon, coming in the evening to meditate the place, saw one brother come and furtively take from his own store and place it upon the store or the pile belonging to his brother. And after he had gone, the other brother came and also furtively took from his store and placed it on the store of his brother. And Solomon gave thanks to God that he had seen this mystery. And he said, not by the rites or sanctities of priesthood is this place dedicated. It is dedicated by brotherly love and unselfishness. And upon this site shall I build the everlasting house of my God. So we look to find the proper land upon which the temple shall be raised. And we know that this land must be a piece of earth sanctified by unselfishness. That it must represent that level in human nature which is the true foundation of eternal truth. That level which thinks more of giving than of gaining. That level which thinks not first of itself, but of another. For it is upon this sincerity alone, this rock Moriah, that the house must stand, which cannot be swept away. For if we build upon the sands of opinion, or upon the uncertain ground of false doctrines, our house will not survive. But Solomon felt that God had showed him the way, and he left this instruction to his son, to forever remember that wherever men of their own accord and in secret and with no hope of gain or reward do most sincerely and honorably and most unselfishly serve each other out of the love and understanding in their own hearts, wherever this occurs, this land is sacred. Wherever this occurs, this house is set aside to the service of the living God, whose name be praised. So perhaps in our own thinking, we can have some idea of how we must go about the building of the universal temple. Certainly it must stand upon the ground of unselfishness. It must stand upon the earth of insight. It must be erected upon the solid foundation of man's virtue, his understanding, his consecration. For if it is not so built, it is not built according to the law. And if it is not built according to the law, the living God will not dwell therein. Then having this foundation, which is the foundation of our own nobility, our own trueness, as apart from superficial and secondary consideration. Upon this foundation, we plan the house. And we call upon the skillful and the good. And we give to each man who labors upon this work the wages that are his proper due. We give to each that credit, that reward, that recognition which is his right. The workman is worthy of his hire. And in this labor, each man is rewarded according to the skill which he possesses, according to the virtue which he has attained, according to the discipline which he has imposed upon himself. So in the building of this house, we must call upon all the skills of mankind. We must call not only upon those skills which arise from crafts and arts and trades, but the skills of professions and of sciences and of religions. We must call upon all, that each may, in its own way, make its contribution. For if in this house any part of man is neglected, if in the building of this temple any craft or science is not present, the house will not be perfect. For in this house there must be gathered together the roots and streams of all knowing. And we must realize that it is only when this is accomplished that a strange and wonderful impregnation takes place. For it is this union which is the resurrection of truth. Truth broken, divided, and destroyed, taken apart as were the robes of the Messiah when the soldiers cast lots for his garment. All these divided procedures, all these fragments, are in themselves lifeless until they are fitted together to make one living thing. And it was the opinion of the ancient magicians, mystics, that all these so-called dead things, imperfect in themselves, when they were brought together and formed into a cunning pattern, that this pattern suddenly became alive, and that in the perfection of work, it is ensouled by its own spiritual unity. It is no longer a mass of rock. It is no longer castings and weavings and adornments. It is one thing. It is the everlasting house. It is the house which goes on because the causes of death are no more. Each workman who labored upon this house was entitled to mark his stone. But each workman also was given a design and a plan. And each labored with the full realization that his success depended upon his keeping the rules of his own plan, and others also doing likewise. If he cut his stone too small, it would not fit in. If it was too large, it would not join with its neighbors. If he departed from the instructions and fashioned it according to his own delight, it fitted nowhere. This is the law of architecture. That the great result, the harmonious pattern, arises from a lawfulness. Each workman duly and properly instructed and consecrated to the fulfillment of that instruction. And when his stone was exactly the shape and size that was demanded of the space, then he might mark it, and he would receive his wages as a true and faithful workman. And he would receive honor. But most of all, he would know that when he gazed upon the finished building, it could not have been quite so perfect had his stone not been there. This was the cult of the Dionysian artificers, the great Syrian order of builders who worshiped God through architecture. And this was the meaning and symbolism of architecture. That it represented a way by which men came to understand the disciplines of cooperation. That great projects come from men working together. That if all work together, the labor is sweet. And all will live to see the glory of their work. For it is said that in the building of the temple of Solomon the king, the joy of the workmen, the consecration under which they labored, and the dedication which motivated their conduct, these were so great that during the whole course of the building, not one laborer sickened or died, and that every man who labored upon that house lived to see its perfection. Now, obviously, this is symbolical. But what does the symbolism mean? It means definitely and certainly that in the building of the universal plan of things, those who labor with the foundations shall live to see the glory of the finished work. The old Pharisees advanced the doctrine of rebirth. They said that only by this law of Gilgulim could these things be achieved. But they were achieved, in the symbolism at least. So we watch around us in the world today as our medieval ancestors did in their time, and we perceive a wonder which sometimes, perhaps, we are thoughtless about, taking too much for granted. We observe the marvelous increase of the glory of knowledge. We perceive the skills which are developing that man has never known before. And in our hearts and minds, we realize how easily this great gathering force of insight could be dedicated to a project worthy of itself. We wonder sometimes how so small and insignificant a creature as man so deserves the wonderful faculties and powers with which he has been endowed. These endowments are given to him because he is a workman. At the time of the building of Solomon's house, it is said there were only three men who knew the complete plan. All the others worked only in faith, worked only according to the laws of their guilds, fully convinced that if each did his duty, the great plan would be perfected. And the master of the work received each day, upon the trestle board of his craft, the tracings by the finger of God concerning the labors of the day. Thus, without full understanding, but in great confidence, disciplined by their integrities and their guilds, the workmen fulfill their various labors, never questioning the glory of the outcome. This was part of the glory of the guilds of medieval Europe, the wonderful dignity of labor, the full realization that the tailor and the coat maker and the shoemaker and the cook, all these were useful people. All of them were making their contribution to this strange, wonderful, and invisible house that had its roots in the unknown past and its spires and pinnacles in the unborn future. All labor, therefore, is the building of one vast structure. And man has been endowed by nature with the faculties and powers to fulfill this structure of labor upon a certain level. As he recognizes his opportunities, his privileges, and his responsibilities, he will become truly the master builder. So in the concept of this, we had a great social ethical pressure. We had a program for human conduct. Religion suddenly became vitalized. And instead of thinking merely of gathering and worshiping at altars that would crumble away, these people, these mystics, including even the Essenes, who had much to say on this subject, recognized the dignity of man, the dignity of the life, quietly but constructively lived. And that somewhere in this great house, every man can place a stone. And every man, as Kipling says, can leave behind him this message to the future, that others will come and build. But they will realize that the past has also known, that the old stones indicate the faith of days gone by, standing firm and strong for the next footings to be raised thereon. This moral concept tied architecture to ethics. It tied the science and arts of building with the great spiritual and moral problem of human existence. And out of this all came the simple concept that we have strongly stated in the Kabbalah, that this whole great procedure that we call creation, evolution, is the building of the eternal house. That this house is built in the universe by the power of God, but that this house is brought down to earth by the goodwill of men, and that the time will come and must come when men will pattern their worldly estates according to the great diagram or plan of the kingdom of heaven. For in the universe is the vast architectural scheme which man must adapt to the building of temporal empire. The Muslim mystics, who had considerable contact, as we have noted before, with the old Jewish priests and prophets, were also very well aware of the implication that has become part of their tradition as well as that of Christianity. They were quite certain in their own minds and in their own sacred writings that there was a mysterious pattern in space, and that this pattern in space has to be captured in various ways by the ingenuity of human consciousness. Actually, men do not invent arts and sciences. They discover principles that have always existed. Learning is an eternal discovery. Every process in nature and in the life of man is either lawful or unlawful. Everything we conceive of has rules. Every process has its own laws. Therefore, wisdom is actually man discovering the laws and the glory of God, as sang David the king. Consequently, in all our seeking, in all our growing, in all our struggling, we must search for lawfulness. We must discover the rules of the great guild of the builders. We must know that there is a way to build this house, that way is an absolute science, that if any inaccuracy arises, the stress will not be adequate. If the house is not built completely and perfectly, it will not stand. Unless the weights and the proportions are according to law, the building will not be adequate for its purposes. Or it will not be beautiful. Or it will collapse of its own weight. Or many ills will fall upon it. So that the building of a house is an exact science, and the building of the great house, the house of universal brotherhood, is also an exact science. We have tried to build according to good humor and kindly intention. We have done much with these, but not enough. We cannot do enough, because purposes, unless united, do not achieve their maximum good. No man knows how to cut his stone unless he sees the men who are cutting the stones that must go with his. No man of himself alone can carve a rock and be certain that it will fit. He must share in the broad total program. And to share in this broad total program, he must elevate the purposes of the whole above his own ambitions, above his own opinions, and above his own ideas. He must have one idea with all who are likewise laboring upon this work. The Kabbalah came into Europe at a time when education was in a rather deplorable state. The story of the colleges of Europe in those days was not a very happy one. It was true that Charles the Great Charlemagne, had gathered the rather unoccupied monks together and forced them to create cloister schools. It was also true that Charlemagne had broken the tradition of the past and practically all royal precedent of his own time and said that it was not unseemly that a king could read and write. This was something that was really a soul-shaking episode. Because up to that time, uselessness was considered as indicative of aristocratic superiority. If you could do anything, you were sort of in trade. If you could do nothing, you were illustrious. It's getting that way again, by the way. It's getting now so that it's rather humiliating to work. And if it was not for a small problem of eating, there probably would be not very much enthusiasm in this direction. But Charlemagne did sense that there was very little glory in governing an empire of fools. So he began to consider the possibility of being the ruler over an intelligent people as perhaps a means of advancing his own glory. But in that time, most learning, most true learning, was centered in the Near East. And the Near East, in turn, had become the refuge of early Christian and Jewish scholars. And the courts of Baghdad were far ahead of Europe in the advancement of knowledge. Many of the scholars among the Arabs who came to Spain with the rise of the Moorish power in that region, many of these who came were of Jewish ancestry and are said to have brought with them the ancient books and rules of the Kabbalah. From these books and rules, such as the Sefer HaZohar, a new kind of insight was bestowed upon the somewhat delinquent European mind. It became more obvious that learning was not only necessary to the advancement of people, but that with all knowledge the Lord must give understanding. And the Kabbalists tried to understand the meaning of understanding. They suspected that it was not mere acceptance, that it was not that kind of attitude that arose merely from the ability to master the multiplication table. They realized that understanding meant a different and deeper dimension of awareness. That understanding had to do with meaning. And meaning, in turn, had to do with the larger patterns of things. That understanding was man's ability to grasp the universal purpose, whereas knowledge might be merely the perpetuation of his own opinions. Man could become learned in the learning of other men. But he could gain understanding only through contemplating the works of God in heaven. Therefore, understanding had to do with the vast laws around him, whereas knowledge might be merely the memorizing of some social code in his own region. Understanding also was the power that gave perspective. Understanding enabled the individual to live for the future. Or as one of the older mystics said, live with the spirit of towardness, going towards something. That understanding gave us some vision of what lay beyond the horizon, which we were slowly approaching. And also understanding was this mysterious energy in us that made us decide to reach that horizon, even though the journey was difficult. And we might suspect that when we came to the end, it would only be the beginning of another journey. So understanding was the power that Solomon asked God to bestow upon him. And it was this understanding which inspired the great pattern of the building of the universal house. Men of understanding were the only ones who could work together, and this is still true. Individuals with true insight can subordinate their personal desires to the accomplishment of some larger common good. Without this understanding, we follow the old tradition that is becoming rather too frequently referred to today. You ask a man today to do something, his quickest answer will be, "What is there in it for me?" This is the perfect statement of no understanding whatever. And this is the kind of situation that means that this individual would never build a good stone or cut a good stone to be put into the house of universal progress. He is the type of individual who probably would go on strike when the temple was half finished, because he felt there should be more in it for him. This problem, then, of understanding affected the early attitude toward learning and prepared the way for the Renaissance. The Renaissance, in turn, brought with it gradually the power of the Reformation. Understanding was man's continual searching for the facts of things. And the biggest fact in all that he could discover was this great fact of the inevitable law of cooperation. To achieve any worthwhile end, men must work together, cheerfully and wisely, lovingly and unselfishly. Not for their own good, but for the common good. Not for their own glory, but for the glory of the Lord. This became a dedication. And even today, this religious dedication is strong in many peoples and is one of our great hopes that in the course of time we shall gain the insight to advance this structure of universal hope. Now, what is this everlasting house that we strive to therefore put together? What do we expect it to be like when it is done? Certainly, it is not going to be a building. It is not going to compete in glass and steel and aluminum with the patterns of modern construction. Yet, in a way, every house that we build, in some degree, calls upon the same skills and calls upon the same fraternity of efforts, but the motives are different. Yet, even with different motives, the same methodology must be used, because there is no other. And for lack of it, the house will fall. But this house that we are seeking to build changes its definition with the changing of our times. Back in the 15th century, one old mystic, who was also, by the way, a Kabbalist, declared that the everlasting house would ultimately take the form of a university. This was a good idea at a time when everybody hoped that they might get to go to school sometime. There wasn't any very great assurance of it, but their great dream and hope was that sometime they could read and write. Therefore, we had the vision of the New Jerusalem, the universal city of the future, as a place where everybody could go to school. In other regions, this house of the future, this wonderful temple of Pansophic wisdom, was to be a place where everybody could get a square meal. This held inducement for a long time, because it represented the idea of the end of hunger, the end of want, the end of that privation which has always sat so heavily upon the multitudes of the world. We have a little of this today. We have a little of both of this, of these lines of thought. In many parts of the world, the future to these people does mean education. the building of a great schoolhouse in their own land. To others, it does mean a house in which there will be no hunger. That indeed, that it will be a house of bread. Then there were others who got a little further along in the 17th century. The utopians, like Campanella and his City of the Sun, had the idea and the vision that in this wonderful city, this new world, there would be a certain democratic state of affairs. The people would share, that the profit would not be so desperately important, that it would be the pride of the city that it had no poor, that all would labor together and share equally. Some of the old colonists came over to this country to try that, but it didn't work so well. Some folks still found a way of doing nothing and being paid for it. Of course, they didn't have the skill we have in that direction now, but they were willing to learn. Also, these utopians dreamed of a righteous kind of government. As one of them expressed it, the ultimate form of human administration.